Our worship team used that song and we showed that video to kick off a sermon series we're jumping back into today called Open Invitation. And we did so the first Sunday of January of 2020, which seems like, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago at this point, something along those lines. So we're jumping back into this tour, this journey through the Gospel of Luke. And last we left off, we were in verse number 6. Oh yeah, and somebody's pointing to a small child saying, please send them away. So, kids, if you're ready to go to Kid Connection, this is the time I got thrown off by the extra video. I'm out of rhythm. So, kids, if you want to go to Kid Connection, you can do so right now, straight out the back if you want to head there. If you're visiting with us and you have no idea what Kid Connection is, it's a time for kids grades K through 6 to have some special time with their peers and their friends and have a message time that is directed specifically at them and where they are at. So, I think I'm sending them to the right place. Yeah, it's going to be fine. We're good. Yes, we're jumping back into this series, Open Invitation, a journey through the Gospel of Luke. And what happened with this series is if you look at the entirety of Luke's Gospel, you will see that Jesus is constantly pushing the boundaries of the kingdom of God, is pushing the margins of who's in and who's out, and is including more and more and more and more people in this list of people that are invited into the kingdom, that are invited to come to the table, as we just saw in that video. Today, the title of the message is Mercy is Strength, and you will see why as we get especially to the end of the passage we're going to read together. We're going to be in Luke chapter 6. We're going to start in verse 27 and go to verse 36 today and listen for the theme of how and why mercy is actually strength. Starting in verse 27, Jesus is speaking and he says, but to those of you who are listening, hopefully that's still us today, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks of you. If anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. If you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Mercy is strength. Now, I typed that title as I was working on the sermon this week, and I thought, mercy is strength. I really like the sound of that. And then I thought, mercy is weakness. It's kind of a fun play on that, which I think is a common phrase. Mercy is weakness is like a common cultural thing. And I started to think, I think that phrase has a foundation somewhere. It comes from something. And so I used a trusty old Google to try and figure out where that came from. And as soon as I realized where it came from, my inner child was completely ashamed of myself. Because the phrase, mercy is weakness, comes from a little 1984 film called The Karate Kid, which I watched, I don't know how many times, but a lot of times as I was growing up. And specifically, there's a scene in the dojo where there's a conversation, and the leader of the dojo essentially says this, we do not train to be merciful here. Mercy is for the weak. Here in the streets in competition, a man confronts you, he is the enemy. And an enemy deserves no mercy. To which Jesus today, we read, says, mercy is strength and not weakness. If I made a list of all the things that I wish Jesus would have never said, what we read today would be really close to the top. Because it's really, really hard. And I'm probably going to repeat that multiple times today. It is really, really hard to do this, love your enemies, be kind to those who are not kind to you. Pray for those who persecute you. It is really, and just compare it to some of the things that have come earlier in the biblical narrative. Compare it, think of like the Ten Commandments. Don't kill people. I can do that, right? Or think about the dietary restrictions in the Old Testament. Don't eat pork. Well, I like bacon a lot, but fine, I can do that. I can avoid certain foods. This like ratchets it up to a volume of 11 and says, beyond that kind of stuff, you are expected as a follower of Jesus to do these kinds of things with, for, and to these kinds of people. And it's really hard. It's not just hard as a Christian. There's a tendency as a human being to identify and define your enemies, and it is as old pretty much as human civilization is old. Because if you look back, I read a fascinating paper this week on the topic. If you look back, as soon as human beings started to group themselves by kinship, basically family ties, you know, extended family ties, and as soon as those kinships of people settled on particular pieces of ground and said, this is mine because I'm going to use it to farm and I'm going to use it for my herds in order to feed them. As soon as multiple people and groups did that, guess what came really quickly on the heels of it? The development of having enemies. Because anybody who threatens or even seems to threaten what is mine or ours becomes an enemy. And it's a long line through history to get us to where we are today, but it's absolutely, some things have changed a lot over that span of time. Our desire to see things through the lens of me versus you or us versus them, it is absolutely the same in a lot of ways. Sometimes this experience of enemy can be a firsthand thing. Think of a kid on the playground who is bullied. That's a firsthand experience of an in-person thing where you are imminently threatened by someone who is trying to harm your physical health. That's one way that you can understand who an enemy might be. But more often than not, I would argue, for most of us, we are probably still not bullies threatened on the playground physically. For most of us, when we understand who our enemies are, it's not because of those firsthand interactions. It's because we are told by people that we trust who our enemies are, and we believe them. We choose to believe who is trustworthy to tell us, here are your enemies or here are our enemies, and we accept what is told to us, and then we fix our lenses so that we understand the you versus me, the we versus them mentality. One of the fascinating things I learned this week is that there was a shift in how we view our enemies in the last 70 years or so, since around the time of the Cold War. Before that, mostly when you talked about your enemies, it was somebody who was standing in front of you, who was an imminent, immediate physical threat to your livelihood. But starting about 70 years ago, things started to switch gears, and now when we talk about our enemies, we don't talk about that so much as we talk about our enemies are those with whom we have ideological differences or differences in values, and it's more of a perceived threat than it is an actual in-person imminent threat to my person. I would argue that trying to encapsulate where we are today in this current cultural moment, I've chosen this phrase. I think that we are swimming around in a sea of toxic adversariality. And I know what you're thinking. Is that even a word? And my answer is, sort of, I think. I looked it up in the dictionary. It's not there. I looked online. It's been used a few other places, so I'm going to claim it as a real word enough. I like it, so I'm going to use it, regardless if it's a word. And I've been accused occasionally of making up words on my own from now and again, so maybe I'm doing that. I don't care. I like this phrase, toxic adversariality, that we are trained and encouraged to have an adversarial view of the world around us, to attach that lens when we look out at our world. And it is absolutely toxic. It teaches us to ask these questions. First of all, who is my enemy? Define that. And then follow that up with, am I prepared to defend whatever that enemy seems to threaten? And am I ready to attack in the same way that my enemy is attacking me? That is what it boils down to is that is the viewpoint of this toxic adversariality that I think exists in our particular cultural moment. But here's the thing. That can only exist So far, think of it as a circuit. As long as a circuit continues to get fed and refed, it'll continue to work. But as soon as you break the circuit, then it stops being able to continue. And I think that what Jesus is teaching here in Luke 6 is a way of breaking the circuitry of toxic adversariality, of saying, I might be treated as an enemy, I might be mistreated, I may be cursed at or cursed against, and if I respond in kind, guess what I'm doing? I'm completing the circuit over and over and over again ad nauseum. But the teachings of Jesus show us that there's a different way, I would argue a better way, that breaks this circuit. And I have to be clear, anytime I talk about something like this, I have to be really, really clear. This does not mean that, for instance, there are extremes, and I'll give you one of them. I would never tell someone who is in an abusive relationship, well, you just need to stay in that relationship because that's how we follow Jesus best. No. There are times, there are extreme situations where we have to remove ourselves from being assaulted or abused, whether it's physically, emotionally, spiritually, those sorts of things, right? So I have to make that disclaimer because I wouldn't want people painting with that broad of a brush. But fighting against this mindset of toxic adversariality, I want to remind you again, this is not easy. This is really, really hard. It's very challenging. But think about this for a second. If you can find me any portion of Scripture, especially in the teachings of Jesus, where he says to his followers, following me will be easy, please tell me where it's at. I would love to preach that message. But I don't think it exists. I think we're told from the beginning and over and over and over again, whether it's the words Jesus used or the way that he lives, we should never expect following him to be easy. And so when we're confronted with something like this, our tendency is to try and think up except fors and whatabouts. Love your enemies, except for. Love your enemies, but what about? If you see that in the text, show me. I don't see it. Just because it's hard doesn't mean we should rebuff it or reject it or deflect it as something that's impossible to do. I would summarize it this way. The only legitimate reason for a follower of Jesus to identify his or her enemies is then to immediately then figure out, how do I love those people? How do I pray for those people? And how do I do good toward those very people? If we are calculating who our enemies are for any other reason, we are doing it wrong. We have one legitimate reason to figure out who is aligning themselves against us, and the only reason is then to figure out, how do I love them? How can I pray for them? How can I do good toward them? And if we can do it, if we can follow Jesus in this way, it's a huge difference maker, like gigantic, enormous difference maker. I think if we put ourselves in opposition to the opposition that's present within this toxic adversariality, that we have an opportunity to stand out against the world around us, to be in contrast with the world around us. Because the world around us is operating on that circuit. Who is harming me? Who is fighting me? Who is my enemy? Great, now I can make a plan to get back at that person in the same way, or maybe a little bit better. But living in the way that Jesus calls us to live, as difficult as it might be, presents an opportunity to be in contrast to the world. I remember being a really young Christian after I decided to start following Jesus. Well, the first time I decided was back at, I forgot the name of it again, Quaker Canyon Camp. I forgot during first service, and I forgot again. Quaker Canyon Camp, I was probably like 7, 8 years old, just, you know, running around, having a good time. We had a chapel. They talk about accepting Jesus into your heart. Everybody else is doing it. The counselors are really excited about it. And so, like, I did it back then. It wasn't until I became a teenager that I think really started to understand and had more of a depth of knowledge. What does it mean to accept Christ, to surrender, to follow him? And I remember going through this phase trying to figure out, as a Christian, as a teenager, how am I going to contrast my life against the default of the world around me? How am I going to do that? You know, things like this. I thought, I'm going to bring my Bible to school. That's a way of contrasting my life with the world around me. I'm going to wear Christian t-shirts. I'm going to listen to Christian music and turn it up really loud in my car as I leave the parking lot. And I mean, I don't know how effective any of those things really were, but I will say this. It's sort of floundering for a life raft when Jesus is cruising by offering us really clear assistance and saying, do you know how your life can be a contrast? Live like this. Because most people are not doing this. This comes from a Christ-centered view of who we are as human beings, and it will be a contrast to the world around you. And I would love to say that this is the default of how we as Christians are viewed today. But I'm going to let you in on a little secret. It is not. We are understood as different, but not in the ways you might hope for. Back in 2000, there was a book that was written based on some Barna research. It was called Unchristian. It came out in 2007, which on one hand seems like a long time ago, but 14 years is really not that long ago either. And in that book, Unchristian, they did some research, Barna did, asking a particular subset of people. At the time, they did thousands of surveys and interviews with people who were between the ages at the time of 16 and 29. So those people today would be between the ages of 30 and 43. So I'm still in that demographic, just barely. But here's what they found. After thousands of surveys and interviews and questions, they asked people in that particular age group, what do you think of Christians? And here's what they found 14 years ago. The sum total of it, to sort of recap it, is this. Christians were believed to be, these were the top answers, hypocritical, superficial, homophobic, judgmental, hyperpolitical, and purposefully connected, disconnected from the world around them. That is not good. Like, that is not a good list of stuff. Really? And I know what you're thinking. Yeah, Pete, but that was like 14 years ago. The world's much different. Things are probably a lot better now. Well, I read an updated Barna study with some similar questions. It was from 2018. It's not better. It is not. In some ways, it's worse. It's a fascinating study because when people were asked if evangelicals are kind and caring and things like that, we think we are by about a 50 or 60% clip, but the rest of respondents, it was like 12, 14%. So we are not known for the things that Jesus... I dream about a day, and maybe this is a pipe dream, I don't care, I'm going to hold on to this optimism, but I dream about a day when there's a survey done and there are questions asked. What do you think about Christians? What makes them different? How are they set apart? And I would love for the number one most popular answer for people to be like, you know what? Those people are so stubborn in how they love people. They are so stubborn, they are determined to love everyone. They're determined to love especially people different from them, even people actively opposed to them. They are stubbornly committed to loving them. How great would that be? If those were the first things, if that's the way that we were contrasted against the default of the world, we have a lot of work to do. And these specifically, the teachings that we're looking at today from Jesus, I think present a tremendous opportunity. And Jesus is really reaching back in some ways to some wisdom literature from the Old Testament, Proverbs 25. If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If your enemy's thirsty, give him water to drink. And in doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Now we read this and we start to think there's that phrase, we're going to kill him with kindness, right? Here's the problem with that phrase. If the end result is still to kill, like to cause some sort of harm, we're still doing it wrong. Because this phrase, now I understand how it can be confusing, because if you were to literally pour burning coals on someone's scalp, it would be a very painful experience for that person. But if you look at the rest of Proverbs 25, you will see there are a lot of metaphors here that are not meant to be taken literally. And this one specifically was a Jewish way of saying, by loving your enemy, you have the opportunity to awaken their conscience so that they realize how they're behaving and how it's affecting the people around them. So the goal is not to just harm them with kindness. The goal is to give them an opportunity for an awakened conscience. And if your conscience is awakened, The end goal is change, not to continue to harm. So it's a good enough reason to say that we need to continue to follow this teaching from Jesus today, because it's an opportunity to be a powerful witness as contrast to the world around us, that toxic adversariality. Following Jesus is a way to stand out in contrast. But there is a deeper and even more important reason to follow this teaching, even beyond the way that it allows us to be a witness in the world. And it's the fact that enemy love is a reflection of the character of God and a way to be known as his children. We read it at the very end of the passage, verses 35 and 36. You will be children of the Most High. Be merciful, because people will be really pleased with you. No. Be merciful because it's the popular thing to do. No, it's not. Be merciful because your Father is merciful. Now, here's where we sometimes actually go the opposite direction, because sometimes when we identify our enemies, when we figure out, here are the people who are my enemies, sometimes what we'll do is we'll say to ourselves, they're not only my enemies, they're God's enemies. And then, man, we double and triple down on being able to make sure to defend what they seem to threaten and be ready to attack whatever they launch at us, because they're not just my enemies, they are enemies of God. Let me tell you something. First of all, if you think God needs you to fight his enemies, I don't understand your thinking. It's like we think God is this toddler on the playground, and what he needs is for us to come up behind and be like, I got your back. Let me take care of your enemies for you. Listen, I'm confident that God is big and strong and powerful enough that if he wants to fight against his enemies, he's more than capable. He doesn't need us. But beyond that, I'm relatively certain God doesn't want us fighting his enemies. Do you know why? Because he's still busy figuring out ways to love them. And if we choose to start fighting them, we are going against his entire design that he has laid out for us. Be merciful because your Father is merciful. Have you ever noticed how common it is for children and grandchildren to mimic or mirror a parent or a grandparent? Those kids are like sponges, and I don't just mean that they're messy, like they absolutely soak in everything and then they mimic it. I love this picture. I don't know who stuck their tongue out first. I'm going to guess it's probably the daughter and then the mom just decided. But, you know, children will mimic the people who are caring for them. Be merciful because the one we call Father is merciful. I read a story this week about children mimicking their parents. A mom and a dad had showed up to pick up a child who was at daycare. So they both converged and were going to pick this boy up. Young boy at a daycare. They're waiting in line to sort of sign him out, and they see the children playing. There's only a few of them left, and their son is on this like plastic car thing, so he's zooming around the play area. And there's only a few other kids left, but there are a couple other kids that ended up trying to build something that ended up being in the way of his place. And they were just sort of laughing at the kids playing, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, clear as a bell, this boy yells, "Hey, get out of my way, idiot!" And at that point, the mom turns to the dad, because this is a phrase that she's pretty certain this child has heard the father utter while he is in the midst of driving around in his particular car. Children will mimic what they see and hear. Why are we merciful? Because the one we call Father is merciful. I mean, we just read in verse 35, he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful because your Father is merciful. And do you know how merciful God is? What the love of enemy looks like from God's perspective? You see, at just the right time, while we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were still ungodly, while we were still stuck in our self-centered sinfulness, while we were very, very really enemies of God, how did God respond to his enemies? He chose to die for them. And with one of his last breaths on the cross, he said, "Forgive them. They don't understand what they're doing." The mercifulness of God is on full display on that cross as Jesus is surrounded by his enemies, whether the actual Roman guards or simply by sinners like you and me. But the mercifulness of God chose to lay down his life and surrender and die that we might live. So how do we respond today? A few things to think and pray through as we finish our time studying Scripture together this morning. Here's the first one. Where do you see the problem of toxic adversariality in the world around you? And are you caught up in the midst of it? Second, if you were to make a list of all the people you consider your enemies or God's enemies, what names would be on that list? And then how might you actively and intentionally love the people who are on that list? Third, spend some time today praying that the Holy Spirit would soften our hardened hearts toward our enemies and use us to awaken the consciences of those who oppose us. And then finally, if nothing else today, thank God for demonstrating his love for us on the cross of Christ while we were his enemies, stuck in our own self-centered sinfulness. So I want to cycle through those reflections one last time. Whenever there's something just sort of grabs your heart or your mind, feel free to close your eyes, bow your head, whatever is helpful for you to listen for the voice of the Spirit speaking to each of us today. And at the close of that time of reflection, I will finish up with a word of prayer.